one way or another, the truth about your story is looking for the light of day. It is looking for the light of day. Our challenge is that we do all kinds of things to kind of keep it under wraps. That whole thing of like, I'm looking for someone looking for me. Here's the thing about that. Like, we want to come into a world in which the people who find me and who are looking for me, like, are looking for me, hopefully. They're glad that I'm in the room, right? The problem with these parts of me is that I'm afraid that when you see them, you're going to leave, right? This is the way human neurobiology works. We don't even have to talk about faith. Like, this just happens to human beings. But we would say that the reason it happens from the biblical narrative perspective is because this is the way we have been made. Which brings us back then to the first two questions that we asked. Where are you this morning? And are you someplace different, perhaps, than where you were yesterday, last evening? Where are you? And what are you looking for? Where are you? And what are you looking for this morning? And as we contemplate that, I want us now, we're going to transition, because what we're going to talk about now is the nature of our stories. We're going to talk about the nature of our stories, how we tell stories, and how shame tends to intersect with that and do things with that, how we tell stories. In the second part, later this morning, we're going to look at a passage from Hebrews, which is going to be the first half of, like, what do we actually do concretely with shame in our lives? And then the third part that we're going to talk about this afternoon is, what does that look like in our communities in very, very concrete ways? But as we do this, we're going to pause, and I just want you to put your writing stuff down, whatever. I just want you to allow, you can close your eyes or not close your eyes, and I want you to listen to these 3 minutes, first 3 minutes of this piece of music that many of you will recognize. First 3 minutes of the second movement of Dvorak's Symphony for a New World, Symphony Number 9. What do you feel?
Exhausted.
Exhausted? Good. It's only 9:30.
Relaxed.
Relaxed. Peace.
Hope.
Lighter. Hope.
Expectant.
Expectant. Discovery. Discovery.
Longing.
Longing.
Joyful.
Joyful. Okay. Now, these are, I'll just say that, with the one exception of our exhausted friend over here, I just want to suggest that, like, what we're now, again, what we're being reminded of is that the things that we're talking about are not primarily abstract ideas. They are embodied experiences, right? You just heard a piece of music, and I want to suggest to you that music is intended to be your life. As we said last night, you are illuminating. I want to suggest to you that your life is to be for others what that music has just been for you. But it is not possible for us to do that if I'm only trying to do it by myself. Does that make sense? It's also important to recognize that in order for us to be that music, to be reminded of that, it's important for us that we be exposed to that kind of living on a regular basis. So I don't know how many of us this morning woke up and turned that piece of music on, but those things of the world that are material, that are of goodness and beauty, are things to which we need constant exposure. Right? Ideas are important only to the degree that they bring us into places of material change, places of which I'm making changes, like, literally, with my physical person. And I do that by making sure that I am being reminded of the story in which I believe I'm living. Because if I'm not reminded, I will forget. And that notion of story is where we now move. Because one of the things that we would say that evil is up to is that from the very beginning, evil wants to bend and twist the way I tell my story, right? It wants to bend and twist the way the woman and the man were telling their story in the Garden of Eden. And one of the first things that it does is that it separates us from the people with whom we're telling our story, right? God says, remember, he doesn't invite God into the conversation. So there are some things that we know about human beings that we said last night that are different than other animals, and that is that we tell stories like no other animals do, as far as we know. Okay? What are some features about human storytelling that are important for us to know in order for us to be aware of what evil want to do to insert shame into that process? Here's the first thing. Your story was being told long before you ever reached the planet. Okay? So I mentioned last night that my parents were 44, 45 when I was born. And, you know, in 1962, if you get pregnant as a 44-year-old woman, people, like, talk about that in ways that are not necessarily pleasant, right? They're not, they don't come, my mom's name was Betty. They didn't come to Betty and it's like, oh my gosh, this is such great news. It's been 11 years since you've had a baby. Let's do it again. No, they were worried for her. Now, here's something else that's important to know. Like, so my mom, was the youngest of four kids herself. And she, when she was 3 years old, her mother died from an ectopic pregnancy. Okay? Now, her dad, though he was well educated, didn't know what to do with his four kids. And so she basically, for the next several years of her life, became functionally an orphan, being kind of sent to home to home to home to home, different families. And so, you know, you're already somebody who, like, you never know when you're going to be, like, deported, so to speak, to the next place, right? And then she finally lands at an aunt's home where her aunt loved her dearly, but her aunt had a problem with manic depressive illness. And so there would be these times when her, like, my mom would wake up and her aunt would have been, like, taken to the hospital in the middle of the night with no explanation for this. And then, like, who knows when she's coming back. Now, so my mom was somebody who, from the very time that she was little, like, people were leaving. Mm-hmm. And, like, when people leave, it makes us anxious. I don't know if you've noticed that or not. And when we get anxious, we do all kinds of things to, like, help us, like, regulate that and control that, right? And so my mom grew up as a person who had a certain level of anxiety about her life. Even though she functioned very well, she was an elementary school teacher for 35 years. I mean, she raised four kids, I mean, in four different decades. Functionally very, very effective in life, right? But she was somewhat anxious. And so by the time she got pregnant with me, she herself was worried about the fact that I was coming into the world. So one of the things that was true about my story is that my story was being told from the perspective of anxiety long before I even ever got here, right? When your parents, whoever your parents are, when your parents got pregnant with you, they started to tell your story. They started to think about you. They started to either like the idea that you were coming or not like the idea that you were coming. And some of us who are here, there may be some of us who are here who are adopted. And we know that if we're adopted, it means somebody at some point gave us away. A whole range of different reasons for why that happens. And that doesn't make it bad. But my brain knows that it's been given away. Like, who wants that? So our stories, the first thing that's important for us to know about our stories is that they begin and they're being told by somebody else long before we ever even show up on the planet. And so when we think about shame operating in our lives, it's important to know it's already been operating in our lives through the lives of other people. Part of what's important for us to know as we move into the process of healing shame is answering some questions about, like, well, what was it really like for my parents to have me come into the world? And we might have ideas about what that were. We might think that it's great because they you know, they're glad that you're here and so forth and so on, because, like, by the time I got actually into the world and I wasn't, like, I was apparently okay. People still wonder, but apparently okay, right? Then everything was, the people were less anxious. But here's the thing, right? When you're anxious as a female and you're pregnant, your cortisol levels go up. and your cortisol levels going up actually affect the neurological development of the, you know, emerging fetus, and which is, you know, that has consequences for things. And so it's important for us to have a better sense of, like, well, gosh, what was the story that people were telling about me before I got here? Here's the second thing. Once you're in the world, your story continues to be told by somebody else for a period of time before you become the primary managing editor of your story. Because you're born into the world, and people are going to decide what to do with you, right? They're going to make you wear certain clothes, right, that you would never be caught dead in as an adult, right? You get to be 2 years old, and they take you on play dates, and you play with people that you think that you hate, right? There are all these decisions, there are all these parts about your story that continue to be told by other people, which is important to know this. Our stories are always told collaboratively. We never, ever are the only author of our story. Captain of my ship, it's horse hooey, right? Neurobiologically, that never really happens. I think ultimately I get to be a certain age and I become the one who has the dominant narrative voice in my story, and that may be true, but I'm always talking, listening to other voices. So my story is always told collaboratively. So here's a question for us. Who are the people in your life, living or dead, who are your primary collaborators in the story that you're telling about your life? Because if we don't know who they are, it doesn't mean that they're not talking to us. And it doesn't mean that shame isn't hijacking their voice. Who are the people, living or dead, who are your primary collaborators as you tell your story? And then, of course, we become more and more capable of telling our story. But as we learned last night when we talk about attachment, that story that we tell is not just something that we tell as a collection of facts about who I am. It's not just about vital statistics. This is my date of birth. This is where I grew up. This is how many siblings I had, so forth and so on. It's not just the facts about my life. The way that I tell my story is how I tell it is as important as the facts that I tell. That story I told you last night about a dog at Christmas time, like, it was only ever told by me in a particular way up until a year ago. I only ever told my story as I'm the youngest of four sons up until a year ago, until I also recognized, gosh, it's also true that I'm the firstborn of a second family. And you see, if I'm the firstborn of a second family, that's a whole different kettle of fish than if you're the youngest. Because anybody here the youngest in your family? Are you sure? Okay. Now, anybody, like, if you're the youngest, did you ever take any heat from your older siblings because you're the youngest? Were you ever accused of, like getting special treatment because you're the youngest? Okay, when I'm a kid, I'm growing up, like, did anybody here know the story of Joseph in the Bible? Uh-huh. When I was growing up, my brothers would call me Little Joseph. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, right in front of my parents. Because I was the person who got to do things, you know, in the 1970s that my brothers didn't get to do in the 1950s. And I'm like, yeah, because we finally had television, right? I mean, like... And of course, the way the story is told in my family is that, like, well, you're Little Joseph, and it's all kind of fun and games and so forth and so on, except there always was just this hint of resentment. Now, of course, nobody would admit this. Nobody would admit this. But again, like, my story is being told collaboratively with other people, and so who are the voices that I'm listening to who are telling me who I am? Now, here's something else. Stories are mostly told, the dominant element of how we tell stories is not with language. Now, language is an important piece, but the brain far more easily remembers what we sense, what we image, and what we feel than the words that we think. The words that we think are primarily vehicles to carry what we sense, what we image, and what we feel. Now, that doesn't mean that words are unimportant. Words are crucially important. But words are significant to the degree that they evoke and create in us emotional salience, emotional sensation, emotional awareness of things, because I tend to pay attention to those things in the world that are emotionally salient. I don't pay attention to, usually, I'm not in the business of like paying attention to watching paint dry. It's not very exciting. I pay attention to things that are emotionally salient. Now, emotionally salient doesn't mean that those things are necessarily pleasant, right? We can have things that are frightening, things that are uncomfortable. Like our skit last night. It's kind of like watching a bad traffic accident taking place in front of you, right? You don't like it, but you can't help but keep watching it. Right? There is this sense that we watch these, that we are connected to it because it's emotionally, viscerally like connecting to me, even if it's unpleasant. Those are the things that I pay attention to. And so most of our story, and this is important when it comes to like how we will dismantle this thing we call shame, most of our story that really has us gripped is the part of our story that we sense, image, and feel. Imagine going to the next five movies that you're going to go see, and you walk into the theater, and when they turn on the movie, all you get is dialogue. There's no music, right? There's no cinematography. It's just, you're just listening to dialogue. I mean, that's going to be a very different experience. You're probably not going to stick around for very long. It's not to suggest that dialogue isn't crucially important. It is, but it's always important in the context of what am I sensing, imaging, and feeling, because most of how stories are told includes and is all about what's going on in the right side of my brain. That makes sense. Which is why it's really a big deal that we recognize that the biblical narrative, for instance, is first and foremost a story. It is not first and foremost theology. It is theology, but it's important to know that theology is our way of making sense of what we sense. It's significant, it's important, it's crucially important that we have it, it's crucially important that we understand it well, but it's also important to know that we can also make the mistake of thinking that our theology is now going to somehow be the higher thing above the story. Because in the end, even if I don't have theology, Good Friday still happened. Easter Sunday still happens. And that has impact. Even if I can't make sense of it, Jesus is still coming for you. Another thing that we know about stories is that we tell stories in order for them to be heard. We tell stories in order for them to be heard. We don't just, you know, like we don't tell stories to a blank wall. We want our stories to be heard. Now, granted, there will be certain elements of our stories that we won't want to tell because we're afraid for them to be heard. But what would it be like for you if I were to say, look, if you were to give me the three events that represent the worst moments of your life, some of which perhaps you haven't even shared with anybody else, if I could guarantee you that someone's going to listen to this and welcome that story into the room and not shame you because of it, is that something you would want to do? Now, you might say, no, I don't want to do that. But we largely would say we don't want to do it because I'm afraid of what I'm going to feel when I see you seeing me for who I am. Does that make sense? But here's the news about this. Our stories can change to some degree when I receive new information about that story, but my story is far more likely and powerfully to change when I tell you my story and I see you hearing and telling my story differently, even as I tell it to you. What does that mean? So, for example, as I said last night, when I'm telling my staff about this story about the dog that wasn't, okay? I'm telling my story to them the way that I've told it dozens and dozens of times. And in the middle of that, they have a reaction that is unlike any one that I've ever had before. And it is that reaction that stops me in my tracks. It's not just them saying, Kurt, that's misinformation. It's not just, you know, a dog, it's a seven-year-old boy. It's their physical response. It's their facial expression. It's their tone of voice. It's their presence in the room with me as we're having this conversation. It is them as they hear the story that actually changes my experience and interpretation of it. How many of us have had the experience of having some part of our story about which we felt terribly ashamed, and in the course of telling someone else, in the very act of telling them, we witness a response in them that changes exactly what we are feeling about our own story in real time and space? Does that make sense? I want to suggest to you that that is a representation of what St. Paul talks about when he says in Romans chapter 12, therefore, don't be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind so that you can know what the will of God is. So that you can know what the will of God is. Now, it's important to know, we in Western world, we read that text, and when I think about like transformation of my mind, I want to change what I'm thinking, right? I want to think right. I want to be right. And the thing is, like, that's not really the way the brain works. Anybody here know, you've heard of Nancy Reagan? Yeah, Nancy Reagan, right? So, I bring up her name because many years ago, before most of you were ever thought about, there was a movement against drugs, and the movement, Nancy Reagan was a spokesperson for this, and she said what? Do you remember what she said? Yeah, you all know that. Yeah, that's good. Now, here's the challenge, and it's a lovely idea, well-intended, but here's the problem. The challenge is that the part of your brain that hears just say no to drugs has got nothing to do with the part of your brain that wants to do the drugs. This is a problem. In that, it's a well-intended effort to shoehorn what I think into the part of my brain that feels the longing for this. And the only way I'm going to change that, really, is if I have an experience that changes my longing first. And the way that we get to longing is through embodied experience. I don't primarily get to longing through logical, linear thought processing. Does that make sense? Right? So this is why, so much of Jesus' teaching, when you read the Gospels, so much of Jesus' teaching, so much of his teaching that then would get him into trouble happens in the wake of him first doing something. He heals on the Sabbath, and then things start to get dicey for everybody, and then he starts to teach in the wake of him actually having healed someone. Does that make sense? And so one of the things then that we recognize about this notion that so much of our story that is significant is really significant first and foremost because it's told without words has to do with this. Not only who are the people who are collaborating with you in telling your story, but what are the embodied experiences that you have with them that put you in a position to have your mind be transformed? Who are the people who are hearing your story regularly? And how many of us, I have a spiritual director that I've been seeing for now 20 years or more now. And so I meet with him once a month, and I've got a couple of men that I've been, for about that same amount of time, meeting every Tuesday morning for a prayer and confession. I don't deserve my life, because I've got a number of different friendships in which, there's just not much about me that they don't know. They know just about everything. And as I tell people, I'm not just a sinner. I'm like a professional sinner. Because I think that anybody who's done something for a really long time and they're really good at it, you could be called a professional, right? And so these are guys who know me, like literally, like inside and out. And there's nothing, I don't know that you can love a person more than to be in the room with them and have them put all their crap on the table and you just stay. And you just stay. But isn't it, and I don't know, now there may be those of you who are in this room who have that, who've had that experience as well, but part of the challenge for me is that, you know, there's some parts of my story that I just feel like I'm making the same confession, like every single Tuesday, right? It's the same thing that I screw up, that I've been screwing up and I can't get out of my head, that I can't get stopped, right? Like, I am an addict. I'm an addict to my sin. And the question is, like, what about those times when, like, anybody here, like, have those parts of you that you're thinking, like, I'm just going to stop talking about them because talking about them doesn't seem to change. And the more I talk about them, the more I'm convinced that when I tell you these things, at some point, you're just going to, like, say, like, will you please just either, like, put up or shut up? Either make the changes or stop talking to me about that. Have you ever had that experience? I want to suggest that in all of us, we all have parts of us for which that will be true until we're dead. And if we don't know that to be the case, then we aren't well known enough. And here's the thing. There may be no greater act of grace that Jesus gives us than to tell us, and that he's like I get it. Like, I know there are going to be parts of you that we're going to be working on until you're dead. And you're worried because, like, you're not getting all your stuff together as fast as you think you need to get it together. And, like, he would say, like, and that reminds me of a rich young ruler that I talked to a long, long time ago, who just, you know, because the rich young ruler, you know, we have this idea, like, that, you know, he comes in Mark, in Mark's gospel, it's a really big thing because, like, the way that that story is told, like no other place in the gospels, the rich young ruler comes to him, and he said, what's the first thing they asked him? What must I do? What must I do to inherit eternal life? And Jesus says, well, what have you done with all the commandments? He says, well, all of them. I've kept them since birth. And Jesus says, great. Go sell everything you have. And then the man turns away. And in Mark's text, it says, Jesus looked at him and loved him. Before the man turns away, he looked at him and loved him. And then Jesus says, man, how hard it is for the rich to enter the kingdom of God. Harder than it is for that. You know, easier for the camel to go through the eye of the needle for that to happen. And then the disciples say, well, how, like, if that's the case, like, who else can get in? And we think that this, we easily interpret this text as being all about wealth, that wealth is a problem. And I want to suggest that it may be about that, but I want to suggest something else. I want to suggest that part of the problem for this is about the notion that I am working really hard to try to get into heaven. He asked, what must I do? What must I do? And what Jesus says when he says, give away everything you have, he's not just saying give away your wealth. He's saying stop working so hard. He's saying, like, you work hard at everything, including wanting to be loved by God. What must you do to enter the kingdom of heaven? Like, there's nothing that you must do. Like, I'm doing everything. Like, I'm going to do this for you. This is a thing that you receive from me. But he doesn't know how to simply receive. And this is how shame works, right? Shame gets us in our stories telling, like, I have to work, work, work. And so even the parts about me that I know that I'm going to be working with eternally, it's upsetting because I feel like I'm always going to have to be working. And I'm not going to be able to work effectively enough to get into the kingdom of heaven. And this is where it's important for us to recognize that my story is being told collaboratively, most of which is not including words, much of which in its desire to be heard, I'm going to have to allow the reality to, I'm going to have to have my story be received over and over and over and over again, because for much of our stories, in order for them to change, it's going to take a repeated conversation with people. It's important to know change doesn't happen overnight. It takes lots and lots and lots of practice. And Jesus is not worried about this. He's not worried about this. He knows it's going to take a long time. I mean, heck, the world's pretty old, right? Why didn't God send Jesus, like, right after Eve bit the fruit, right? It would have been so much more convenient for all of us, right? It takes a long time to do this. And then there's the last thing that we want to say about storytelling, and that's this. If we are telling our story to someone else who's listening deeply, it's important to know that if you are the listener, that you are just as important in that storytelling process as the speaker is. That in fact, you as a listener, enable that story to be told effectively, even as much as the storyteller themselves has to be effective in telling it. You become the one who invites this story into a space that the speaker isn't really always sure that they ever have, that kind of a space. So the question is not just, who are the people who are hearing you and helping you tell your story? It's also the question of, who are the people that you are listening to and you are also helping them tell their story? We become increasingly effective at telling our story, moving toward the healing of shame, effective doing that, increasingly so to the degree that we are also putting ourselves in a position to listening to other people's stories as they do the same, as they talk to us. That means that we ask important questions. Now, so this is just some concrete stuff for like listening skills, right? There are five, in the English language at least, there are five interrogatory words that we use for asking questions. We all know what these are, right? There's who, what, where, when, how, and then why. One of the most important things that you can begin to practice doing is using the question why less and less and less. And here's a reason why. It is common. I mean, we can use the why question pretty interchangeably. Like, why did that happen? Why did you do this? Why did you do that? And what we're really asking in those moments is, how did that take place? We're really asking the question how. But the word why also easily carries with it the freight of accusation. Why did you do that? Why did that happen? Right? When the mom asks, why did my son not come home from Afghanistan? She's not asking a question. She's making an accusation. And an understandable one, right? She is posing a lament. She's really making the statement, there is no excuse for this. There is no solution for this. There is no salve for this. Asking questions, who, what, where, when, how, enable us to ask questions that actually acquire information and take the felt sense of shame off the table more effectively. So as we are listening to people, we can ask them. We can say things like, tell me more about that. We can ask, how did that make you feel? We can ask, where did that take place? We can ask, what did your mom say when that took place? We can ask, what was that like for you? As opposed to like, well, why did you do that? All part of storytelling. So I think right now, what we're going to do, if I have this right, we're going to have our 10 minutes for reflection. Is that right? Okay. So I'm going to come back to the two questions that we asked last night and early this morning, like, where are you? What are you looking for? What do you want? But then we're just going to take about 10 minutes for some quiet reflection, thinking, writing around this question. Of the things that we've heard so far this morning about storytelling, I want you to choose from some of the following and just write some reflections on. Number one, what do you know about what was being told about you before you were born that has emotional salience? What was being told about me? Number two, who are the people with whom I'm collaborating who are helping me tell the story that I tell? Who are the voices that are contributing to my narrative? Good, bad, or indifferent? Number three, feel free to write down, when I think about my story, what are the images, sensations, or feelings that first come to mind? Not just what are the words. Are the images and sensations that come to mind reflective of Dvorak's Ninth Symphony? Or are they something that's more painful? Next. Who are the people to whom I tell my story? Not just who helped me tell it, but who are the people to whom I tell my story that are listening and enabling me to tell my story effectively? And then last, how comfortable am I being part of the storytelling process by being the listener? And where do I perhaps sense God calling me to be more of that as a part of the healing of other people's shame as well? Now, I've given you a bunch of things you can reflect on. You can take one of those. Just take one of them and reflect on it for a while. So we're going to take what? How many minutes? 10 minutes. We're going to take 10 minutes. So back at 10:20, what's going to happen at 10:20? We're going to take a break at 10:20, right? So we're going to go to 10:20. And so I think what we'll do is we'll have Brian will come up and like cut us loose for a break at 10:20. So just reflect, write, give yourself time to take some of this in.